The Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement will come to order. It's Tuesday, March 11th, 2014. I think we're going to have members floating in and out. Why don't we start with the minutes? My usual, everyone's checked to make sure your name is spelled right.
Mm-hmm. There is one correction.
Oh, there
just
is.
Just pointed
okay.
out to me that this should be
Tuesday. Okay. Oh, yeah, right. One of our testifiers last week, Edward Reynoso, is the political director of the Teamsters Joint Council. So that is correction on page one. Okay, then Senator Johnson moves approval of the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The first item on the agenda tonight is the TRA and Duluth Teachers Consolidation. And should we start with the staff?
Members, this is packet item two in your packet. There are three pieces to it. We put the bill separate because it's somewhat lengthy, and there are some amendments. They're separate, and then the staff memo. Basically, what you're looking at here is a full consolidation of the Duluth Teachers Plan into TRA. It would be put in play over the period 2014-2015. It would be completed on June 30, 2015. If it's approved by three entities, the Duluth Teachers Board of Trustees, the Duluth Teachers Membership, and the TRA Board of Trustees. It does provide for state aid, and there will be an amendment to correct the amount of the state aid with the revamped actuarial information received about 3 weeks ago. So it's in the neighborhood of $14 million annually for state aid, and that would continue until TRA is both fully funded and does not have a deficiency in its contributions that would necessitate a member and employer contribution rate increase. Would have the practical effect of providing retired Duluth teachers with the same post-retirement increase that TRA is currently receiving. That's up from the Duluth teacher 1% per year, and it would be a 2%. The Duluth teacher employees would be transferred to TRA. Members, that's a short version of the bill. I think Ms. Hacking or someone from TRA probably at this point should present, since they really formulated the draft legislation.
Who's going to present on for the Duluth merger?
Madam Chair.
Senator Murphy. Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, I would like to announce that the Speaker gave me a target yesterday for the pension bill for the Duluth merger and the St. Paul of $22 million.
Good work. That is just for this biennium. And then did they give you a tail target too?
From $44 million. For fiscal year 14-15, above $22 million above base, with a tails target of $44 million.
I think we might need more than that. Oh, you're right. That's about right. Great. Now, Senator Pappas better get to work. welcome.
Madam Chair, my name is Laurie Hacking with the Teachers Retirement Association.
Jay Stoffel, Deputy Director of Teachers Retirement Association.
Dave Johnson with the Duluth Retirement Fund Association.
Madam Madam Chair, with your permission, I'd like to sort of start, and I think you have a handout that we just provided to you that gives you a little background about consolidation. I think Mr. Martin touched the highlights of the bills, but as you know, the reason we're here is there was additional aid provided to Duluth and St. Paul teachers last session, but as part of that discussion, there was a request to do a study of potential consolidation of Duluth and St. Paul into TRA. We completed that study, and as a result of that, the Duluth Teachers Board did vote in support of consolidation because of their financial difficulties that they're facing, and I think Mr. Johnson will go into that a little later in some detail. Upon receiving that request for consolidation, the TRA board considered it and said that they, too, would support the consolidation with a condition that there be sufficient financial aid and assistance to TRA to assure that TRA assets are protected, that there's no financial harm done to TRA, and there would be no subsidy of the Duluth Teachers Fund by TRA members and our contributing school districts. In the box on the first page of the handout is just a brief description of our financial status in terms of market value. I would stress that these are market value numbers, not actuarial value, but assets as of the last valuation for TRA were $18 billion. We had liabilities of $23.4 billion, leaving us with an unfunded liability at market value of $5.4 billion, and a funding ratio of 76.9%, and efficiency of 1.73%. TRA has made a tremendous amount of progress since our low point back in 2009. We've recovered and are doing much, much better, but we're not out of the woods yet. We still do have a unfunded liability and a deficiency that we are trying to manage and monitor very closely. Duluth teachers, as of that same date, had $205 million in assets, $352 million liabilities, and unfunded of $147 million, leaving them with a funded ratio of 58.3, but a very large deficiency of over 10% of payroll. And I believe if you recall getting the presentation from your actuary, the Milliman firm, Duluth is facing significant problems, and I think the expectation is that this deficiency that they were running is likely to get larger because of the adverse demographics that they are facing. So hence, that really is the reason this bill is before you, to try to address that problem. I want to go over the actuarial analysis so that you understand the numbers and the background for it. We did a substantial amount of analysis on this, and it showed that in order to bring in Duluth so that TRA assets are not tapped or were not financially harmed, we would need slightly over $14 million annually. Again, to cover the unfunded liabilities and not affect us. This aid would have to begin in actually fiscal 2016 because of the timing of the merger would be as of July 1, 2015. So the aid amount would have to begin in that fiscal 2016.
So, Ms. Hacking, I have two questions to ask and one to clarify. So you have almost 18 months for consolidation. You would not consolidate for, it's March now, March, April, May, June, 15 months to consolidate. Why is it going to take so long? I mean, you did the report. We knew this was coming. Why will it take 15 months? And then with that delay, does that mean that TRA is not requesting aid this year, but it would start in the tails then?
Madam Chair, to your last question, yes, that's right. It would be the aid would begin in fiscal 2016, not this year. And the reason for the delay is actually a hard-learned experience. We brought in Minneapolis teachers a few years ago, and it was done very quickly. It was very disruptive, not so much somewhat for TRA, but particularly for Minneapolis teachers. the data transfer, the records transfer, really takes time. And it, under a careful consideration, we've mapped out a consolidation in a planned manner so that by the point of consolidation, we can be up and running and really have all the members and the records integrated into our system. We TRA has a very highly automated system. Duluth has somewhat of that, but we have image. All of our records are imaged. Duluth's records are not imaged. So there is a lot of work to be done, and we don't want member services to kind of be disrupted during this time. And I want to mention, too, that even though the administrative consolidation actually will start upon enactment of this bill, if it is passed, we will start that work, but the actual finalization wouldn't be until the end of 2015. However, with respect to the assets, you'll see in the bill the intention is to start to move the assets over to the SBI for management really as soon as possible and no later than the end of this year, December of 2014, and hopefully sooner than that.
And is there any reason to not begin the aid this year? Why delay the aid, the state aid?
We would be happy to take it a year earlier. Technically, the liabilities, the way the bill is written, the liabilities would show up on our books really fully beginning in fiscal 2016. So that's why the aid was timed to coincide with our absorbing those liabilities.
Okay. Thank you. Continue.
Okay. So on page 2 of the handout, I wanted to clarify that in addition to the $14 million that we are requesting, there's some pre-existing aid that Duluth gets from previous legislation, and that is $346,000 per year in special state aid and approximately $200,000 in amortization aid. That's an approximate number because that $200,000 varies from year to year based on a formula that we don't control. So that's the $14 million is in addition to those pre-existing special state aid amounts. I want to emphasize that the calculations were done using TRA's assumptions, that is how entry age normal calculation is done with our fund, mortality assumptions, payroll growth assumptions, all were TRA's assumptions, and also the benefit structure. And really the main difference there, as was mentioned by Mr. Martin, is a 2% COLA. Currently, Duluth gets a 1% COLA. Under this consolidation proposal, it would move up to 2%. So that was all factored into the actuarial calculations and the aid amount. And again, Mr. Martin mentioned this. These aid amounts would continue throughout TRA's remaining 24-year amortization period unless we attain full funding earlier than that, and we would have also would have to have a sufficiency under our contribution stabilizer language. So that's not projected to happen, but if markets are really excellent, that it could happen, in which case the aid would cease. So just to finish up here, I want to emphasize why we need this additional assistance. It's really to cover Duluth's unfunded liability and pay it off. We're not getting this money in an upfront lump sum amount. We're agreeing to take this in installments, so to speak, payments over a 24-year period. And that's the precedent that was used in prior consolidations. As you can see on the earlier page, TRA itself has its own funding challenges, and we really feel we can't absorb Duluth's additional liabilities without harming our status, and that's why we need the aid. And we want to avoid a situation in which TRA and its contributing members would be subsidizing the Duluth consolidation. And then last, I would just point out at the bottom of this page that because this aid is spread over a 24-year period, there is risk. There is risk that the aid amounts might get disrupted, reduced, or brought to a zero at any given year because it is subject to your annual appropriations process. So there's a risk to that. There's also a very high risk of adverse investment experience, and if that occurs, it makes the unfunded liabilities a lot larger and therefore more difficult to manage financially. And also, lastly, the discussion about whether to change our interest assumption, the current 8.5% assumption. If that were lowered, that would make the unfunded liabilities higher and the unfunded liabilities higher than they are being calculated at today. So those are risks that we run that I just want to call your attention to. And with that, in your handout, we have a description of the section by section of the bill, but I think Mr. Martin has hit those highlights, and we could take some questions at this point, or you might want to hear from Mr. Johnson on Duluth's perspective.
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dave Johnson, and I work as a pension consultant to the Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund Association. And there's been a number of hearings on this, so I can be relatively brief in terms of summing it up, but there have been significant demographic changes in the Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund Association over the last 20 years due to declining enrollment in the Duluth schools, some legislative enactments that's moved about 250 members of the fund into TRA already, and other things that were not within the DTRFA board's control that led to a demographic shift whereby 20 years ago there were two actives to every retiree, and now that's switched. So there's two retired members roughly for every active, and we talked about that when we talked about the study. We came here last year to address the deficiency that resulted from that and some stock market problems that have happened over the last decade, and policymakers asked us to look at consolidation along with TRA. We did that, and we came to the conclusion, the Duluth Board came to the conclusion that it made sense for the Duluth Fund to consolidate. Over time, we think this is a more cost-effective result than staying independent, given the demographics. And so the Duluth Board has passed a resolution supporting a full consolidation into TRA as opposed to an administrative consolidation. And some of the requirements in the bill reflect the board's resolution with respect to the consolidation, especially the member vote, which is consistent with most other consolidations. And there are some legal reasons related to its status as a nonprofit corporation to consolidate them as well. So I'm happy to answer any other questions, Madam Chair, that you or members of the commission may have. But I know you've heard a lot of the background before.
Any questions from members of the commission? Okay. Did you have anything more you wanted to present to us before we take testimony?
I would just like to indicate that of the amendments that Mr. Martin has mentioned, we appreciate your adopting the technical amendments through 1A, 2A, 3A, 4A, and then in addition, the amendment that also Mr. Martin mentioned, that the aid amount that is being requested needs to be updated, and that's it's on page.
She said 1A or 2A.
It's 10.7. Instead of the 15,047, it should be 14,377,000.
We're going to take the testimony first. Okay, we'll take those amendments after we take the testimony.
Okay.
So I'd like to invite Mr. Munsterman and Mr. Leathers. We'll try to bring people up in teams. And there's another chair up there. So Ms. Doslin, want to join them at the table. Mr. Munsterman, welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, my name is Walt Munsterman. I'm the President of Education Minnesota Retired Teachers, and we represent approximately 7,000 teachers. I want to thank the Commission for the work you've been doing. I've been following the Commission for about 15 years, and I've been very pleased with what has taken place. And also, I'm very thankful for the meetings that were held this summer because they were very informative meetings and a lot of education took place for many, many people. I'm here tonight to express our support of the Duluth Consolidation. We have followed this as an organization all the way through with the TRA board as they have worked and put together this legislation as per the mandate. We agree wholeheartedly with it. However, our major concern is that it must be done with the proper funding. Without that, of course, it would have could have a negative impact upon retirees and also active teachers. So again, we do support this consolidation on behalf of Education Minnesota Retired. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Leathers.
Madam Chair, Commission members, my name is Don Leathers. I'm the legislative co-chair, or one of the legislative co-chairs for the Retired Educators Association of Minnesota. And we represent roughly 7,200 members. And we support the fully funded merger of the Duluth teachers with TRA as outlined in the 2013 consolidation study for the following reasons. And many of these things you've heard before, they've been brought up tonight, but I need to represent my people, and that is the past practice and precedent for requiring full funding for consolidation of Minneapolis teachers. In 2006, the Minneapolis Employees Retirement Fund, MRF, in 2010, and the Minneapolis Police and Firefighters into PARA in 2011. And the 2013 pension law directed that the three pension funds study a potential merger, quote, in a manner consistent with past practices that assure the assets of TRA are protected. As you found out earlier tonight, the Duluth Fund is about 58% funded. The bill should go forward with no harm done to TRA and its beneficiaries. And as Mr. Johnson mentioned, the Duluth Fund is in trouble for many reasons that are out of the control of the board and the system. The number of active teachers has decreased. The number of students has dramatically decreased. And MNSCU members and charter school members have been admitted into TRA. Many of our members have expressed concerns about perhaps their benefits will be diminished in the future if Duluth isn't brought in fully funded. We do allow active teachers with five or fewer years to be in our organization, and they're also concerned. We believe the TRA's benefits are modest, and if further reductions are made, that would be very unfortunate. Finally, we firmly believe that a strong, uniform TRA fund is in the best interest of educators, both retired and active, and of the taxpayers of Minnesota, and we would urge you to include the Duluth TRA merger in the omnibus pension bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for these witnesses? Then Ms. Doslin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Dosland, and I represent the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, most popularly known as the school superintendents throughout our state. I just wanted to affirm MASA's support for the merger, but just reiterate what these two gentlemen next to me and what Ms. Hacking shared with you earlier is we strongly support the additional funding that TRA has requested and to assure that TRA and its contributing members and school districts would not be subsidizing the Duluth consolidation. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Next, thank you very much. Let's bring up Mr. Rigstad and Mr. Harold from the Duluth Board of Trustees. Welcome to the Commission.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the Commission, my name is Paul Rigstad. I'm a retired Duluth mathematics teacher and a member of the Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund Board of Trustees. I started teaching in Duluth in September of 1962 and have been on the DTRFA board almost continuously since 1984. Having served as the president for 4 years. I want to thank you for this opportunity to address the Commission and also thank the Commission for their long history of strong oversight and support of all of the public pensions funds of Minnesota. I am proud of the strong history of the DTRFA and its ability to serve the teachers of Duluth for over 100 years. The trustees have always worked hard to provide a secure fund and provide for the best interest of the members. Others have provided or will provide you with what I perceive as adequate, convincing numerical and financial information of the historical successes and unfortunate circumstances that have led to the need for a more permanent solution to today's problem. As a trustee, I am convinced that it is my fiduciary responsibility to our members to agree with the other trustees who have unanimously supported the consolidation recommendation that has been prepared for the Pension Commission and the resulting Bill House File 1951. It is important for both the active and retired members of the fund that the funding and demographic problems be addressed quickly. I urge you to support our request for consolidation with TRA and to follow the procedures that have been developed for a smooth and orderly transition. It is important that the Duluth teachers be received and perceived as full contributing members of TRA and are provided with all of the benefits and opportunities as are the current members.
Thank you, Mr. Rigstead. Mr. Harold.
Madam Chair and members of the Pension Commission, my name is Dean Harold, and I'm a middle school teacher from the Duluth Public Schools. I've been a teacher for over 25 years. I'm also a trustee for the Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund Association and have been on the board since 2001. My main reason for being here this evening is not to go through the points why our Board of Trustees has asked to be consolidated with TRA. I will say that I am proud of our board and that we have always taken our fiduciary responsibilities very seriously. We've always tried to act responsibly and have made many tough decisions to keep our funds sustainable. But we are at a point now with events that have happened that were well beyond our control where our fund needs help. The real reason I am before you is so that you can hear from an active member of the Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund. I'm not comfortable as a public speaker, as you probably can tell. If you get in front of some sixth grade students, I'd be much more comfortable. So please bear with me. I've lived in Duluth all my life, going to school in Duluth Public Schools and graduating from Duluth Denfeld. I went to the University of Minnesota Duluth to get my teaching degree, and many years later earned my master's degree from the College of St. Scholastica, which is also in Duluth. So as you can see, I have not ventured very far from home. Today, I am a single dad and have two boys in Duluth Public Schools, one in ninth grade and one in seventh grade. I never decided to become a teacher to get rich or because it was easy, but because I feel I relate well with children and teens. Okay, most teens. It's not so easy some days when you're dealing with your own kids. When I first started teaching, like so many young teachers, I knew that I was paying into a retirement plan through the school district, but never really paid attention to it. I saw it on the check stub, but that was it. It wasn't until I started a family that I finally looked at what my retirement plan was all about. It is a plan to help someone live comfortably in retirement, something that he or she can count on. That is something I want and need. I still have some time before I retire, but I want to feel confident that when I do, I will have the same benefits as other teachers around the state. I feel that I've earned that, especially working in a middle school for so many years. So if it helps you to put a face with the Duluth Teachers group here asking for your support on this bill to consolidate DTRFA with the TRA, you can use me, but know this. Know that I am one of many from Duluth who have retired or will retire in the future. Know that we are a proud group of educators that want consolidation with TRA only because of the circumstances that make it impossible for us to keep going without help from other sources. Know that solving this issue will only become more expensive the longer it gets put off. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Mr. Harold. Ms. Beer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Jody Boer. I'm with Education Minnesota, and I'm here tonight. First of all, I'd like to make sure, I believe all of you received a copy of our letter of support from our president, Denise Specht, that went out. So I'm here, Madam Chair, committee members, to just go on the record to let you know that we do strongly support this bill and the consolidation of Duluth into the TRA. In light of all the work that's been done on this bill and to ensure that the state aid that's needed is there to hold the TRA members harmless, we strongly support it. And I just also want to make mention of, Madam Chair, if I could, and committee members, that we have a room full of active and retired Duluth folks with us. I know many of them talked to you today and others, and they spent the day here talking to people about this issue, took time out of their day. That's how important it is. And so I just want to thank you for listening to them and taking time to meet with them as well. This is very important, and we thank you and urge your support. Thank you.
You're welcome. Kim Crockett. We have to go to the amendments.
Madam Chair, I've got two to hand out that are technical. Members, the first amendment is the 18A amendment. This relates to the amount of the appropriation in the bill. When this was first calculated, the identified dollar amount was $14.7 million. With the revised actuarial work, it's now $14,034 million. And so this resets the numbers. The reason why the numbers you see there are somewhat larger, it includes the $346,000 that Duluth is already getting. And so this consolidates the current $346,000 with the new $14,034 number.
Is there any discussion? All in favor of the adoption of the 18A?
Have we moved it, Madam Chair? Madam Chair, I'll move.
No. Thank you, Michael.
I'll move the S-1803-18A amendment.
Is there any further discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. 18A.
Members, the other handout, and this is the last of the handout amendments that I have. This is something that's requested by the Legislative Auditor's Office. The Legislative Auditor is directed in the bill to conduct an audit of the TRA plan and the Duluth teacher consolidation. The way it was framed in the bill is more prescriptive and unnecessary than what is usually provided for, and this is a stripped-down version of the audit requirement. And Mr. Nobles is here should there be any questions.
And Mr. Nobles spoke to me about this before the meeting and is recommending passage.
Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson.
I'll move the 17A amendment.
On the two handouts, which is the
is there any further discussion? All in favor of the adoption of Amendment 17A, say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted. 17A.
Then the other amendment before us is the 18A amendment.
No, that's already been done.
It's already been done. Oh, I didn't get to vote for it? Okay. So now we're going to the amendments in the packet.
Yes, members, there are three technical amendments that staff has identified. This would be the 1A, 2A, and 3A amendments. 1A simply tries to clarify the aid termination date. It's contingent on two things happening, and those two things may not happen at the same time. And if we don't provide for a whichever is later provision, there may be some confusion at that point in time. So that's the 1A amendment, just simply keeps the two events that trigger the termination of the aid, but because they may not be coincidental, it handles that possibility. 2A moves a clause relating to the reemployment of the Duluth teacher staff. There's a clause that just seems to be modifying something other than what was intended, so we move it closer to the actual intended noun. And then 3A relates to the revisor of statutes. Since the consolidation will be effective when three entities all approve it, the revisor of statutes doesn't necessarily know that will have occurred. And for purposes of knowing when or if notes are needed in the future editions of Minnesota statutes, it's a good idea. There's been some difficulty in our past consolidations, which were contingent on non-governmental entities making the approvals, that the revisor was having some difficulty tracking them. And so this provides explicitly for a filing with the revisor. So that's 1A, 2A, and 3A. You can either do them separately or do them in a single motion as you see fit.
I believe Ms. Hacking said that the TRA does support these three technical amendments. Does anyone else want to comment? All right, then.
Madam Chair, I move adoption of 1A, 2A, 3A.
Any more questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Then members, we have the Board of Investment.
Yes, okay. Members, the 4A amendment, this is in your packet. This is a somewhat longer amendment. This would be page 39 of your packet. This is requested by the State Board of Investment. Mr. Perry is here. Some of it is already in the bill, and it's just repositioning, and there are some differences. It has to do with the transfer of assets, and in particular what to do with the assets that either the State Board of Investment currently cannot hold or under its policies would prefer not to hold, and how those are going to be disposed of.
Mr. Perry, would you like to comment on this? Is this at your request? Is that correct?
Madam Chair and members, what we are asking for is just basically some of the timing to ensure that.
Could you repeat your name for the tape, please?
Mansco Perry, Executive Director of the State Board of Investment. What we are asking for is some specificity in the timing to ensure that we have enough time to transfer the assets to the state. For most of the liquid assets, this will be no problem, but there are some private equity assets for which before we could take them, they'd have to be reviewed by the Attorney General's office for the State Board of Investment. And also there would have to be agreement by the general partner to allow the State Board of Investment to replace the Duluth teachers as the limited partner for those. And then the Duluth system also holds two buildings, I believe, and the State Board of Investment does not and cannot hold direct interest in any real estate.
So this amendment meets your needs?
Yes.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Could we hear from Ms. Hacking and Mr. Johnson?
Madam Chair, Lori Hacking with Teachers Retirement, and Representative Murphy, yes, we support this amendment.
Madam Chair, we support it as well.
Okay. Madam Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Johnson, do you have anything about those two buildings to offer us?
The only thing that I'm aware of, Madam Chair and Representative Murphy, is that they're in the process of looking at those buildings and selling them. I know the board's had some discussions about how best to dispose of them, and they're aware that they have to dispose of them consistent with their fiduciary obligations under Chapter 356A.
Madam Chair.
Representative Murphy.
I move adoption of 4A.
Any other questions? Anyone else want to testify on 4A? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Mr. Martin, did you want to talk about 11A and 12A?
Members, the 11A amendment, and you can find this on page 57 of the packet. There is a difference in our past precedent. There was indemnification of the Consolidating Pension Plan Board in the Minneapolis teacher instance in 2006. There was not indemnification of the MRF board when MRF was consolidated in 2010. The bill provides for indemnification, and this would remove the indemnification if you want to follow the MRF precedent. If you are comfortable with the Minneapolis teacher precedent, then this amendment would not be necessary.
Ms. Hacking.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, members of the Commission, we don't support this amendment. We believe that the indemnification that the Duluth Board is currently receiving should continue even after consolidation, so we believe the bill as currently drafted is appropriate, and it does follow the model of Minneapolis teachers, and I think this needs to remain in there with no amendment to it.
And the 12A amendment, Mr. Martin?
Members, the 12A amendment attempts to tighten down the transfer of employees of the Duluth Teachers Plan. Right now, the language does not make employment date specific, so it doesn't require that the employees have been employed for any period of time, and it also would guarantee them the same salary level in the future as whatever their salary might be at the time of consolidation. I'm suggesting that you might want to have some at least minimum period of employment so there's not adding on of extra employees solely to have them transferred in employment. And then if you are concerned about the salary issue, this would be lines 1.4 to 1.6. It would tie their salary to that in effect as of May 2013 plus an increase of no more than some percent for you to specify.
These were the Duluth employees?
Yes.
Any comments on this provision by Ms. Hacking or Mr. Johnson?
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, we don't really support this amendment. We don't think it's necessary. We're in pretty close contact with the Duluth staff and have already engaged in discussions about bringing them on board TRA once, assuming this merger bill passes. So we again, don't think this is a necessary amendment, and we're really not concerned about it, the issue.
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We also don't support the amendment. Actually, over the past years, we've discussed consolidation. We've had the opposite problem, which is trying to keep these folks from looking for other jobs, given the fact that the pension fund has been in limbo in terms of whether it's going to consolidate or not. And the two employees that have stayed or the employees that have stayed have been there for a significant period of time.
You have quite a few groups that have to approve this consolidation. And is there any reason you left out the school district, Independent School District 709? That's the 15A amendment.
I believe, Madam Chair, I believe we were following the pattern of Minneapolis teachers, and I don't believe the school district was involved in the approval of that. I know there was a member, someone representing the school district here. We haven't had a request that they be part of this approval process.
I think,
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, I think in some of the past consolidations, too, there's been significant increased liabilities based on the employers, which required them to sign off on it through a member vote, and that's not the case in this particular consolidation.
Any other questions? Anyone else want to testify? Then Representative Murphy, you ready for the motion? You want to move to put it in the omnibus bill?
Madam Chair, I move that
this bill.
House, Senate File 1803, House File 1951, as amended, be placed in the omnibus bill.
Is there any more discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Representative Lesh is going to be back in a few minutes. He asked me to wait with the number three on the agenda. So why don't we take number four on the agenda? This is Mr. Barrick. And just give us a brief recap.
Members, number four on the agenda is Senate File 1713, House File 2163. And
this is the SBI one,
this,
right?
Right. This is the SBI bill.
Mr. Perry, you might want to come to the table again, too. Why don't we just wait a minute till these people. Thank you all come for coming from Duluth.
Thank
Good
you.
Luck.
Thank you.
Okay.
The bill gives the State Board of Investment broad authority to offer a wide array of diversified but unspecified investment offerings. In particular, it expands the investment offerings under MSRS Unclassified and the Public Employees Defined Contribution Plan. And it expands the exclusion from liability provisions to also exclude from any liability from investment losses or any sort of investment problems SBI's executive director and SBI's staff. Two key issues that are presented by this bill is, first of all, these liability exclusion provisions. Are they needed at all? And if they are needed, in what form should they be? Right now, in this drafting, these liability exclusion provisions are basically a list of individuals, organizations that are not to be held liable if there is an investment problem. And a problem with this kind of approach is that when you have a laundry list like this, it may be the case that if you're not on the list, then perhaps you are liable for investment losses. So there's a question of whether that's the right way to go or whether instead, if these provisions are needed at all, whether rather than saying who is not liable, we should couch these provisions in terms of who is liable, in particular placing the liability firmly on the individual covered by the particular plan, since these are defined contribution plans where the individual is making the investment choices from among the options that are available. The other general issue is one of just how much freedom the commission and legislature wants to give to SBI. Under the changes in this bill, the specific names of the accounts in the supplemental fund, which is used by the MSRS Unclassified Plan, which many legislators are in. It's also used for the MSRS State Deferred Comp Plan and several others. Currently, the particular investment accounts are named in the statute. And so SBI can't really change those names or change the nature of the offerings without coming to the legislature for approval. Given the drafting in this bill, the names would no longer appear. Therefore, SBI would have flexibility to change the names of those accounts as it saw fit and whenever it saw fit. And it also SBI is also given the authority to considerably expand the offerings again at its will rather than under specific legislative authorization. So those are the issues presented by the bill. There are a few amendments there. One is technical. Three are substantive. If there's interest in those, I can provide a little more background on that. But at this point, I turn it back to the chair.
Mr. Bergstrom.
Madam Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom, and I'm the director of the Minnesota State Retirement System. We are asking for authority to add investment options to the unclassified plan and the health care savings plan, and it would also apply to PERA's defined contribution plan. We currently have a similar investment authority for our deferred comp plan, and it really gives us more flexibility. The current investment options have been in place for over 30 years. Quite frankly, some of the names are outdated, some of the names are misleading. In addition, we would like to add some new products. For sure, one would be target date funds. So the bill is really fairly simple. We would just like the authority and the State Board of Investment to be able to choose and add investment options to the unclassified plan and also our health care savings plan.
Hey, Mr. Perry.
We're just here. We're in support of the MSRS, excuse me, Mansco Perry, the executive director of the State Board of Investment. We're in support of MSRS providing additional options. Our only aspect of the bill is to give us a bit better flexibility in describing what options are that we provide in the supplemental investment plan, and also to give us the capability of changing options without coming back to the legislature to do so. We don't at this point in time plan on making any changes, although we looked at some of our options and determined that these do need to be changed.
Any questions? Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify? Mr. Bergstrom and Mr. Perry, would you comment on the potential amendments in that packet?
Yep. Madam Chair, the number 1A is fine, except the official name should be Qualified Default Investment Alternatives. That's the Department of Labor's official term. So I don't mind. The concept is fine, but it should really read Qualified Default Investment Alternatives.
So replacing the term default options with qualified
Default Investment Alternatives.
Alternative.
That's the official name that the Department of Labor uses. And, Madam Chair, we're also comfortable with 2A. Prefer not 3A and 4A at this point.
Okay. We are lacking a quorum on the House side, so we're going to act as a subcommittee of the Pension Board until we have our quorum restored so that the subcommittee will consider these amendments, and then later on we will adopt the recommendations of the subcommittee. A little convoluted. So do we have a motion for the 1A amendment?
I didn't respond.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson moves the 1A amendment. Any more discussion? Oh, wait, we had to make the language change.
Help me.
Mr. Burke, you want to explain the verbal amendment then, the change in the 1A? I think it's delete options and insert qualified default investment alternatives.
Okay, right. Page 13. It's page 13 in your packet.
The packet?
I don't know how formal you want to be. Basically,
and amend the amendment.
You'd be amending the amendment by striking investment allocations where it appears in the amendment and inserting qualified default investment alternatives.
that correct, Mr. Bergstrom?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Do you want to incorporate that into your amendment?
I'll incorporate that into the amendment, yes.
All right. Then that language, as stated by Mr. Burek, is incorporated into the 1A amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Then let's look at the 2A. Anything more to discuss on the 2A amendment? And Representative Nelson moves the 2A amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Then if we could have a motion to incorporate 1713 Senate File House File 2163 as amended. We say as amended when we did the first bill.
Yes.
Okay. As amended, the recommendation into the omnibus bill, the subcommittee is recommending that.
Yeah.
All those in favor say, who's making the motion?
I will.
All right. Representative Kahn moves that. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay. Let's go then. Representative Lesch isn't here yet, so let's go to number five.
Members, number five in your packet is the PERA contribution rate increase bill. And this is you've taken testimony on this issue both for PERA General from Ms. Vanek and also for MSRS General and MSRS Correctional during the tag end of the interim when they presented their mandatory recommendations for contribution rate increases under their stabilizer provisions. The bill is PERA General. The Amendment 5A would be the recommendation of the MSRS Board for their contribution rate increases. This bill was scheduled before the MSRS bill was introduced. That's why we're doing this by amendment, but it's the identical language. The amendments are, the other amendments, 1 through 4, are only of interest if you want to have a larger contribution rate increase than requested by PERA because it covers only a portion of the current deficiency.
Okay. Ms. Vanek?
Madam Chair and members, for the record, Mary Vanek, PERA Executive Director. We support the bill as presented. More than a decade ago, we had contribution needs, and we sought them in several legislative sessions. We were not successful in getting what we needed, and as a result, we requested this stabilizer language that really puts it up to the board to recommend incremental changes, and the employers supported that because we waited too long. We had almost a 2% deficiency, and we needed to catch up quickly. And so the employers and the employee groups supported the fact that we should approach this more incrementally. Therefore, we received that stabilizer language through support from the LCPR and the legislature to allow our board to make recommendations. We, however, put an implementation date of July 1, the beginning of the fiscal year. But routinely, we have implemented contribution rate increases on January 1st to better align with local government's budgeting needs. So we had to come to you this year with a bill to change that date. Our bill recommends a 0.25% contribution rate increase for both employee and employer and asks that we move that date to January. Mr. Martin is correct that it is not addressing our full actuarial deficiency. However, our market value deficiency is 0.15% of pay. So with the smoothing of assets, the way we smooth assets, we in 2013 recognized the last year, the last 20% portion of the 2009 serious loss in the market. That will be dropped off the books now. So the board wanted to wait and see the impact of not having that large negative in our actuarial assessment and if our markets hold this year to see what the impact is. If we don't have to recommend another contribution rate increase next year because we're below the threshold, we would not want to impose one. If we do need one, we'll be back, as the stabilizer language requires, to request another 0.25% each. So we'd prefer not to put it in statute at this time. The board's position is to move forward with 0.25% each, change the date to January, and allow the next valuation to see where we are. With respect to other issues in Mr. Martin's memo, we do agree with him that we need to have further discussion. The change from 8.5 in the future, if we lock in at 8, will generate needs for contributions. The recognition of when we switch from a 1% to 2.5% post-retirement adjustment will increase our liabilities and create concerns or we'll need to address funding. But I think we need to have a bigger discussion about those rather than than assuming for them and already putting in place those contribution rate increases until we have those discussions.
Mr. Bergstrom, did you want to comment on the 5A? This was, I believe, your legislation.
Madam Chair, Dave Bergstrom, the Director of the Minnesota State Retirement System. We have the identical bill in bill form, so if you want to deal with it as an amendment or if you would rather hear it as a bill, that is your choice. But we would be supportive.
We want to deal with it as an amendment.
Okay.
Tonight. Do you want to just explain, talk a little bit about the amendment?
Yep, Madam Chair. We are proposing a 0.5% employee contribution rate for our general plan and a 0.5% employer contribution rate for our general plan. On a market value, we currently have a deficiency of 0.8%, and this would eliminate that because we would be increasing contributions a total of 1%. We are also proposing for our correctional plan a 0.5% employee and a 0.75% employer. The reason those are different, the Pension Commission policy treats public safety plans with a 40% employee and a 60% employer split. That's in your principles, and that's what our board followed. Both of these would be effective July 1 of 2014.
Are there any questions from members of the commission? Is there anyone in the audience who wants to comment on either the 5A or the bill itself? Okay, is there a motion for the 5A? Whoops. Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Keith Carlson with the Minnesota Intercounty Association with me as Ann Finn. It's the League of Minnesota Cities. I just want to indicate our support for the bill as presented. We understand the concerns that are behind the suggested amendments, but I believe, first, that the commission should understand since June 30th of last year, market valuations, the S&P 500, the broad measure of the stock market, has gone up more than 16%. So the necessity of any further increases is really unclear until we get the next round of actuarial reports. And again, as Ms. Vanek pointed out, your actuary identified a long-term deficiency of 0.15%, and we agree with the PERA board that the incremental approach that the current law provides is the appropriate way to deal with this, especially because since 2005, our contributions have gone up nearly 45% with this additional quarter percent. So we urge the commission to go slow in doing any further increases. With that, I'll conclude. Be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can I be reminded again when the actuarial report is due or in front of us? When is that report up in front of us? The actuary.
members, the pension plans provide their actuarial work typically in December every year. Mm-hmm. The Pension Commission's retained actuary summarized the actuarial reports of the various pension plans last Tuesday at the Pension Commission meeting.
Another year before we see the results of that market trend.
Senator, it would be the valuations as of July 1, 2014, which would be filed in December, typically, of 2014.
Ms. Finn?
Yep. Madam Chair, members, Ann Finn representing the League of Minnesota Cities. The League supports this initiative as presented. We also supported the stabilization plan that came before you and ultimately passed. At that time, we had the knowledge that contribution increases were a real possibility. We have alerted our members to the likely implementation of increases this year, and just wanted to make a comment that the January 1st date is especially helpful to local units of government because our fiscal year aligns with the calendar year, and so having that effective date is very helpful. And with that, I conclude. Thank you.
Okay. Anyone else?
You do the 5A amendment. You can do first. Yeah.
Does someone want to offer the 5A amendment?
Madam Chair,
Nelson moves.
I'll move the 5A amendment.
Moves the 5A amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. You want to move the bill then, too?
And, Madam Chair, I'll move Senate File 2263 as amended.
House File 2448.
Right. House File 20. Yeah, it's not on my piece of paper.
Any more discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
That again is a subcommittee.
That's a subcommittee, right, adopted by the subcommittee. So I didn't put it in the omnibus bill.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Representative Lesch is here.
Representative Lesch is here. Let's go back, revert back then to number three on the agenda, Senate File 1802, House File 2520, and invite Mr. Doan, Mr. Rice.
He's over in the corner.
Sorry?
No one is right over here.
Okay, great. He wants something to be passed out. Now we have four. So you could go back and adopt. You can, whatever you want to do.
I'll sit over here.
I'm not giving up the gavel, though.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I'm move your subcommittee reports right away.
Should we do that? Representative Murphy, would you move the subcommittee report? I can state it.
Madam Chair, I move adoption of the subcommittee report.
The subcommittee report includes Senate File 1713 and Senate File 2263. So we'll adopt the report, and then we'll incorporate those bills into the omnibus bill. All those in favor of approving the subcommittee report, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Now, Representative Murphy moves that 1713 and Senate File 2263 in the subcommittee report, or the subcommittee report itself, be incorporated into the omnibus pension bill.
Exactly my words.
Thank you. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. And Lisa will put the proper words in there. Okay, Mr. Doan, Mr. Rice, welcome to the commission.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Chairman.
Tell us what you'd like to do.
To proceed?
Just, yeah, summarize. Unless does the staff want to start? Do you want to say anything? Mr. Burek? We'll let Mr. Burek say a few words.
Okay.
Members of the commission, what this bill does is it would provide an additional $7 million per year in state aid for the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund Association through 2042, which under the bill is going to be the St. Paul Teachers full funding date. And the second thing that the bill does is it replaces the current rolling amortization procedure that's used by St. Paul, 25-year rolling, with a fixed funding date. And that's July 1, 2042. If you want me to go over the policy issues, or do you want to wait? Or
Why don't we wait? Okay. We'll let Mr. Doan explain it then. Okay, Mr. Doan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the Commission. It's a pleasure to be with you today and to present the legislation kindly sponsored by Representative Lesch on the House side and Senator Pappas on the Senate side. This is a matter that has been discussed in the past in terms of some of the Commission meetings. You do know that from the report that was done on the consolidation, it was the decision of the Board of St. Paul Teachers, based upon the information that is presently known, that it was their preference to remain as a separate entity at this point in time. Doesn't mean that down the line, I guess, things couldn't change. But the circumstances at this point, in our view, point toward remaining as a separate entity. I've provided for you, first let me say that the bill itself is kind of an extension of the matter considered last year, in which the board, the board came to the commission, and the commission did approve, and the legislature approved as well the provision for $7 million in additional supplemental assistance to the fund. We had asked for it to be for an extended period through the time of achieving full funding. The legislature approved it for the two-year period for last October and for this upcoming October. And I think that was in part to give time for the study to be done, and that was completed. And the results of that study, in our view, not only very thorough, but also pointed toward the advantages for the system at this point to remain a separate plan. The second part of the proposal, so the first part of the proposal would be to continue as we requested in the past, that the $7 million annually be appropriated until a date in the future of 2042 or until we achieve full funding, whichever comes sooner. The second part of the proposal, as Mr. Burek has mentioned, is to establish, and again, this is as a follow-on to recommendations not only by the board itself, but which is echoed by the commission's actuary, Milliman, in its most recent report and its some of its prior reports, that the concept of the rolling 25-year amortization period never really achieves the goal of accomplishing a full funding period. I would agree with that, and I think that under the circumstances, it's the preference of the board to replace that with a fixed date. And so we have come up with a period of 2042, which is recommended by our actuary. The 2042 date is set on the basis that by 2017, in the next two fiscal years, in essence, all of the built-in contribution increases will have taken place. And at that point, we would then measure a 25-year standard, 25-year period from 2017 to accomplish the full funding of our liabilities, which ends up being 2042. So that's what the bill accomplishes. I've passed out a handout with six different attachments associated with it. I'd be happy to go through any or all of those that the commission may want. I've tried to, in these attachments, cover the basic bases that are important to our consideration of the recommendation that it remain a separate fund, as well as to address some of the points that were raised in the memo by the commission staff. Quickly summarize the points anyway. Attachment one is the a graph that shows, or a table that shows, work by our actuary, Gabriel Rhoda Smith, and it demonstrates that under various scenarios, the likelihood of achieving full funding and the scenarios that are identified there involve doing nothing, only accomplishing the second portion that we're requesting today, which is to fix the date at 2042. And the third scenario would be to provide for the $7 million in annual funding as well as establish the funding date of 2042. And as you can see, only under Scenario 3 by 2042 does the fund come out with a sufficiency, in essence meeting all its obligations. And it's for that reason that we feel that based upon this report and on the belief that the assumptions that are within our plans are achievable, that we can, in fact, achieve full funding by the date of 2042 with the additional $7 million from the state.
Mr. Doan, that seems more than sufficient.
Yes, Mr. Burek has pointed that out. Madam Chair, the process here is that we're working with numbers that aren't so precise that there isn't some room for some flexibility or maneuvering here. I think the safeguard is that if we were to achieve full funding sooner, that the $7 million under our provision from the state would stop.
And full funding is defined as 100%.
100%. But again, this being sort of a process of trying to deal with future assumptions, best guesstimates, and so forth, having that extra cushion, we feel, is an important element. But the in terms of the safety to the state taxpayer, the provision falls that if we do achieve full funding prior to 2042, we would not require additional assistance from the state.
Just remind me, Ms. Hacking, did you define full funding as 101% with the merger with Duluth? Am I misremembering something?
Madam Chair, Laurie Hacking. No, we defined it as 100% funded, not 101. The 1% refers to our contribution stabilizer, which actually all three of the statewide systems have, which says that if we not only become 100% funded, but if we start to have a sufficiency of 1% of payroll, then we can start reducing contribution rates. That's the way the stabilizer works.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Mr. Doan, do you want to continue?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The second attachment is in a sort of a précis, I guess, or a summary of the some of the items that the board, in its reflection on making a decision on how to proceed, found that there were probably 10 or 12 different reasons. Those are all included in the report. I've identified seven of them here just for reference. But to highlight those, I guess I would focus on the fact that the board at this point has a preference to remain with a 1% COLA from a funding standpoint and prudence of a 1% COLA. It does have a we have implemented a newly established pension administration system, which we anticipate will achieve great efficiencies within our staff operations and responding to member issues and so forth. It's an expenditure of some significance. It's important to the system, and it's been newly implemented, and we would like to have the opportunity to continue to perfect that system. Primarily, however, I think the issue boils down to the fact that we feel, from the standpoint of our fiduciary responsibility to both our members and our school, St. Paul School District, as well as the taxpayers of Minnesota, that the costs associated with merging with the TRA are dramatically higher than they are if we were to remain separate. And for that reason, that, among the other items mentioned here, were some of the considerations that went into the board's decision at this time to remain as a separate entity. On item three, I've just highlighted some steps that the board on its own has taken within the last two or three years in terms of coming to this legislature and receiving support to accomplish a variety of steps that have been very important in terms of improving the fiscal sustainability, financial sustainability of the system. And the point I'd like to, well, there's a couple of points here I guess I'd stress, but one of them is not only that we have made dramatic increases, almost 40% increases in contribution rates from the employer and employee, and operational savings as well, but just in this past few weeks, we have transferred over $250 million in assets to the State Board of Investment as an indication of good faith in terms of trying to find every possible niche that we can to economize and realize savings. And obviously, I'm projecting at this point that the savings in management fees by moving to the state for that amount of money, roughly $255 million, will save the system close to $1 million in fees. And the bottom point on the page here that I don't want the commission to lose sight of is the fact that with these changes that have recently been implemented, for the first time in this last fiscal year, the rate of growth from our contributions actually exceeded the rate of growth from our annuity payments. And that's a very positive sign. It's not only demonstrating the benefit of the changes that we've implemented, both operationally and from a contribution standpoint, but it also covers the fact that many of our retirees are now switching, in terms of the demographic within the fund, from a predominance of basic plan members whose retirement benefits were much greater to coordinated plan members whose benefits obviously have the advantage of participating in Social Security and are less so. So as that continues to happen, we feel this trend will continue to improve, and that will only be a solid gain or strengthening the sustainability of the system itself. Attachment number four identifies the comparative costs of the system, and again, we feel as though it's substantially less of an impact dollar-wise upon the state for the system to remain separate. We feel it's roughly a $7 million cost that we're asking for here versus the $46 million that was built into the plan as done by TRA's actuary, Kavanaugh McDonald, and was a part of the performance of a consolidation report. And in terms of the question that Mr. Burek raised about in his report about why is the state, in fact, being asked to come up with all of the additional funding that we're requesting, I've tried to address that here in attachment number five, pointing out the fact that employees are already being asked to pay substantially more than a normal employee in terms of meeting the normal costs that exist within the system. They're practically paying 100% of the normal cost, which is very unusual in a pension system. That, in essence, says that every active employee today is paying everything they need to meet their obligations in the future when they do retire, not even accounting for any potential appreciation through investment return from those assets. Secondly, our employer has also stepped up to the plate very effectively. Not only do they pay among the highest in the state at 10.34%, but they make an additional payment as well of $800,000 and have been asked to pitch in on several of the operational changes that we've made over the last several years, in which the employer is contributing some additional funding. And then finally is the point that just for historic purposes, but very importantly, back in 1978, this legislature removed from our system and our system only the ability to achieve that supplemental payment that was made by employers of about 4% of salary. And what I've done is to construct a graph, which is item number six, which is very complicated, but the effect of that is to show that between 1978 and 1994, when the legislature reinstituted that payment that was really directed for unfunded liability, monies that were lost during that time period and their participation in the market, there couldn't have been a worse time to be out of the market. You can see how much in terms of dollars in the first column there, or the third column actually on that page, called shortfalls. That's the amount of money that was lost to the system every year from 1978 to 1994. Then I projected out what each one of those would have generated based upon the returns actually produced by the fund in that time period, up until 1994, when a portion of the assets, a portion of that fund was reinstituted. And then I projected further from 1994 to the present, and down in the lower right, you can see that had the St. Paul's system had the advantage of those funds that were removed by legislative action in 1978, our system today would have a hypothetical $300-some-odd million additional assets. If you were to place that $350 million on top of our current asset base, which is slightly over $1 billion, you would come up with a situation where the assets that we have relative to the liabilities would be approximately 87-88% funded system at the present time. And that is the very reason why the St. Paul system was never able to achieve anything above 80% funding, while all other systems in the state, major systems, did realize several points over the last 10 or 15 years, a 100% funding. And so we were sort of singled out for that. We've suffered for it. But we feel we're on the road to regaining that level of fundedness. And with the much-needed support from the state, we hope to get there.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for Mr. Doan? Is there, Mr. Rice, did you want to add anything? We're good.
Just briefly, Madam Chair, just quickly, this fund has had a very good track record in terms of investment return. You annually require the state auditor to compare rates of return, and the most recent report shows that this fund's actually done better than the State Board of Investment over the last 10-year period. The fund has had lower COLAs than TRA and some of the other major plans, and when you've had information on that in the past too, and its administrative costs have all been very reasonable within the charges that PRA or TRA has had. So I've always said this is the little engine that could. It's survived maybe despite of the odds. It's been well run. It's had good returns. It does not have the demographic problems that Duluth has. St. Paul School District is the largest school district in the state now. Kind of competes with Anoka-Hennepin. There's 4,100 teachers. That's actually up 300 teachers from just 4 years ago. It's one of the best urban school districts in the country. It's produced good results, all of these consolidation issues have been unique, and I think there is a strong case that the state extending the support to this plan is the best choice that you have in front of it. If you had another $80 million in the target biennium that Representative Murphy talked about, would the district and would the members be interested in a bigger COLA increase? Sure, but the reality is that I think you, Senator Pappas, and Representative Murphy have gone a long, long way to fixing two problems tonight. We'd encourage you to support the bill, and we'd really applaud. This has been a long time to get to this point. It's been 20 years that this issue's been raised to the Pension Commission. There's been help in past years, but we think this is the, combined with what you did last year and with the $7 million continuing additional, we can have as much confidence as humanly possible that this is the best approach to fix this plan as well.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify? Then I just want to clarify that there's no request from St. Paul for additional funds in this biennium. The $7 million is already funded for this biennium. The request is in the tails, $14 million in the next biennium, correct?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
And then for Duluth, there also is no request in this biennium because the merger is going to take until next year. So the request for Duluth is also in the tails, which is around additional, around $28
million. Oh, my
God. Okay, just want to make sure I'm on the right track. Then Representative Lesh.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Murphy. You requested too much.
The way you put it is different than the way the Speaker put our target. And
he'll be very thrilled you can give him money back.
Madam Chair, I think what we've heard right along is that the sooner we can get new money in, the better off we will be. And so
we have that additional $14 million for Duluth starting this year, or that initial $14 million. They would reach full funding sooner.
That's correct, and we would be less risky. And I think TRA would be happier. The membership of TRA would be happier than if we're waiting around. And
it's good faith effort that it's going to happen, the money.
That's my feeling, Madam Chair.
Representative Lesh, you want to move the bill?
I would move. the bill, Madam Chair, and that it be included. What's my motion, Madam Chair?
That 1804, House Bill 2520, be incorporated into the omnibus bill.
That is my motion, Madam Chair.
There's no amendments.
Madam Chair, is it 1804 or 1802?
I'm sorry, 1802, on my eyesight. So Representative Lesch moves that Senate Bill 1802, House File 2520, be incorporated into the omnibus bill. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So I think...
She's taking lessons from Garofalo.
Those are five words.
So, Mary?
Everything's affected in
2015. We still need to ask. Do that.
You know better.
We do it by amendment.
We do it by amendment.
Let's have Editor Barry can fix that for our next meeting.
Okay.
But I'm assuming I can get the money. I mean, I'm fine with that.
I don't know, and that's why I'm... Right. I just think not having it right away is a mistake.
And don't need the $7 million for St. Paul's. The last bill on the agenda is Senate File 2015, House File 2524, PERA. Ms. Fanick. I'm just very excited we're not having 4 or 5 hour meetings.
Madam Chair and members, Mary Fanick, Executive Director.
This is not going to take 3 hours, is it?
It should not, Madam Chair. This bill is a compilation.
Wait, before you start, why don't we let Mr. Burek just talk a little bit from the staff perspective.
Members, this is, in effect, in part, a minor admin bill. It's sort of a collection of miscellaneous provisions. The first provision or two in the bill is some language that revises PERA's payroll porting requirements to require that for each payroll period, PERA would be getting information on salary, including the breakdown of the portion of the salary that represents overtime or compensation compensatory pay. Excuse me. My understanding is that PERA is interested in this information in order to improve their administration of the plan and to enable PERA to obtain more information about whether loading of the high five may be an issue. The second section of the bill is the start of some provisions relating to the ParaPro program, which is a program for returning annuitants who go back into parapublic employment. There is a program in place. It is set to expire in June of this year, if not extended, that enables individuals to return to employment with a government subdivision, providing the employment is does not exceed a certain number of hours or a certain percent of full-time employment. And in Section 2, we begin with some changes to the ParaPro program. One of the changes in here later is to extend the program. And if we're going to extend the program, then the question of whether it should be modified in some way becomes relevant. And in Section 2, what PERA is proposing is that, and these are on lines 3.24, 3.25, rather than permitting the employee to come back to a position with any governmental subdivision, the employment to be covered by this program would have to be with the same governmental subdivision. Section 3 deals with the duration of the parapro program, and what is happening in this provision is that rather than permitting the initial appointment to the program, which is for a one-year period, and up to four additional renewals, the renewals would be limited to no more than two. Section 4 would keep the parapro program in existence through 2022 rather than expiring in this year. Section 5 is some cleanup of the para police and fire early retirement provision. In part, it's because of an additional section in the bill where that would be Section 7, where PARA is trying to clarify the treatment for county sheriffs. In some legislation last year, there was an effort to give county sheriffs a little bit of additional time to terminate employment if they wish to retire early without incurring less advantageous early retirement provisions. What PARA is indicating in Section 5 is, frankly, that language did not quite work out. In Section 7, they're trying to restate it in a way that that presumably now works. These individuals would be given until February 1st of 2015 to retire early, in other words, under age 55, and still be afforded the full benefit of the early retirement provision without any lessening of the subsidies that would be phased in over time. An issue with the bill is, frankly, while the provisions relating to the ParaPro program is this program that is worthwhile and is worth extending. If it is worth extending, is it worth extending with the particular changes that PARA is proposing here? And relating to the treatment of the county sheriffs in early retirement situations, an issue is whether, in fact, the situation as covered last year was not sufficient. In other words, do you really need to address this and clean it up in Section 7? Given that the early retirement reduction changes that were enacted last year are phased in very, very slowly, so it really makes little difference whether this provision is in here or not. However, I would add that if the commission does conclude that Section 7 should remain in the bill, there may be a need for an additional amendment, which I can discuss if that need arises. With those comments, I turn it back to the chair.
All right, Ms. Vanek.
Okay, Madam Chair and members, Mary Vanek, Executive Director. In the first provision that Mr. Barrett described, we are asking that our statute specifically require employers give us a breakdown of overtime that they pay to individuals. We have been asked to assess whether or not overtime is being incurred mostly in the last 5 years, essentially padding salaries in the last years before employment or before retirement. We have no way of assessing that because we don't have the data. And so we're asking that employers give it to us on a routine basis so we can see at what ages or in what parts of the employment years individuals are being paid overtime, because it can make a difference to the funding overall. If it is paid routinely throughout the career, then it is generally part of the salary that we value into our liabilities. Or if their salaries are remaining low throughout the majority of their employment period, and then they're all of a sudden higher at the end, which then we'll all of a sudden realize a much larger liability than we were anticipating. We can't assess that without the data. And we asked employers to provide data to us this last summer to try to get at least a snapshot of it. We didn't get full cooperation. Employers said, you don't require that we report this to you. We don't have time. We're not going to do it. We understood. It was an exceptional request. But also the data that we did collect didn't give us a sufficient picture. So what we're asking for is that it become part of the routine for reporting, and we've delayed it until January 1st because we also have to program to accommodate recording that data. So that's this section of the bill. The one thing I would ask, because it was pointed out to us by the counties, that the way we're asking for information on compensatory pay is doesn't necessarily align with exactly what we're looking for. So on line, Mr. Burek, if you'd help me out here, on line 2.11, we'd like to strike or compensatory. And on line 2.12, after the comma, we'd like to insert pay for unused compensatory hours, comma. So the idea here is that if I have employees who work an 80-hour pay period, and if they work their 80 hours in 9 days, that's it. They can take that other day off because they're comping out their time. But in some local units of government, they're allowed to bank their compensatory time. So then if it's reported in one big lump sum that gets put into, say, the high five period, we want to know about that. So I understand that the counties reported, well, we have people comp time off in regular pay period all the time. Do we have to report that? That's not what we're asking for. We're asking that for that banked, unused compensatory time to be reported to us. So that's in that section of the bill. In the next section of
Before we go on, Mr. Burek, could you read that amendment?
Members, the amendment would be page 2, line 11. Delete or compensatory, and page 2, line 12, before and insert pay for unused compensatory time, comma.
Madam Chair, do you want to take that amendment separately from the other changes or all together?
We can do that amendment now.
I so move.
Okay. All those in favor of the amendment as read by Mr. Burek, say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay, Ms. Fanick.
Madam Chair and members, Section 2 of the bill, as Mr. Burek described, is our phased retirement option program. And this was requested by employers back in 2009. The state has a similar program in which individuals who are employed can, at a certain point in their career, in our particular plan, they must be at least age 62, can choose to reduce the number of hours they're working and start to collect their pension. And the idea was that it would give employers the opportunity to retain valuable, knowledgeable people on a part-time basis to transition those job responsibilities to somebody else and allow the individual then to phase into retirement. This provision was due to sunset June 30th of this year. We did not have a lot of use of it. About 430 people actually used the phased retirement program. The board decided they would like to extend it for another five-year period because if it is used more, then we want to do an actuarial analysis to see if it is causing an impact on the funding of the plan. Because these individuals no longer pay contributions nor do their employers when they go into the phased retirement program. We asked that it be limited to a total of 3 years, the first agreement, and then 2 years beyond, because typically that's what we have experienced. That's how it's been used. It hasn't typically been used for a total of 5 years. The bill as written would sunset the ability to enter into any agreements on July 1st, 2019, but any agreement entered into in June of 2019 would allow to continue for up to the full 3 years, and that's why there's a 2022 expiration date on it. This is very much appreciated by employers and employees alike, and there are employers here who will, or employer representatives who will testify to that if you need that. No amendments in that section. In the next section, last year you carved out an exception for the elected sheriffs that as we are implementing our change in early retirement reduction factors in the police and fire plan, there was a request of the elected sheriffs that their terms of office do not expire until January 2015. We start this phase in July 1st of 2014. They asked to be exempted. The date that was used as the expiration of their term in last year's codified statute is not an accurate date. We also felt that because this is a temporary provision, that language shouldn't be codified. It should be in session law so we don't have to come back and clean it up. And that's why we asked Mr. Barrick to prepare the language that is presented. There is a concern, however, on the date that's stated on line 6.5. We did some checking with the Secretary of State's office about what is the last day in office for an elected sheriff, and it doesn't align with what is known for state offices. So what we came up with is that rather than before February 1st, we thought it should say, and by the final day in office, in January 2015, as reported by the county or the applicable county, whichever you prefer. So essentially, if the county reports to us the sheriff's last day in office is January 5th, we take that. If they report it to us as January 6th, we take that. We know it will be in January 2015, but it varies by jurisdiction as to what date they give us.
Could you say that language again?
Yes, Madam Chair. We'd like to delete before February 1, comma, and insert by the final day in office in January, and after 2015, insert as reported by the county.
And Mr. Burek, did you want to change any of that language?
Members, I, excuse me.
Get you some water.
I don't believe that in 2015 you said anything about striking that. Don't we need to strike that? I believe on line 6.5 we would have to strike before February 1st, 2015, and then insert your new language.
Just repeat the 2015 then. By the final day in office in January 2015, as reported by the county. Okay. Okay, does anybody want to move that?
I will.
Senator Rosen moves that language. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. We have any questions for Ms. Vanek? Then we have a couple testifiers, Mr. Carlson and Mr. Rice. We have 3 minutes. Still trying to make it to a dinner, Mary. Okay, dinner at St. Paul Hotel. Mm-hmm. Start at 6:30.
What?
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, members, Keith Carlson with the Minnesota Intercounty Association.
At home here.
I generally want to speak in favor of the phased retirement option changes in this bill, extending the duration of the program. This is particularly important for county and other local government employers because of the drain that we're going to see in our veteran employees because of the maturation of the baby boom. We need to be able to do anything we can to fill those positions, including tapping into the experienced employees that otherwise will retire. As a consequence, we'll certainly defer to the desires of the commission on the issue, but we would like this program to be as flexible as possible and would rather see the duration remain at up to 5 years rather than the 3 years proposed by this bill, and also allow it to be used when an individual switches employers. The issue for us that sort of precipitates our need for the flexibility, other than the, obviously the demographics that I've already run through, is a change in federal law regarding access to individuals' health care savings plans has been unfortunately restricted. The employees that are eligible for the phased retirement option have to be over age 62. And basically, for the 3 years until they reach age 65 and qualify for Medicare, they're looking for ways to manage their health care cost, and many have assumed that they could access their health care savings plans to pay for some of their health care costs. Now, federal law has changed and basically said that unless their termination is for at least half a year, 26 weeks, that they can't access those accounts. So we're facing the conflicting provisions of federal law that will potentially restrict our access to these employees, and the provisions in here that are also somewhat restrictive. So again, we support basically the extension of the program. We would like the flexibility that exists in current law, but again, we'll defer to the judgment of the commission. With that, I'll conclude my testimony and be happy to answer any
questions. Mr. Carlson, do you have a proposed amendment? I mean, is it easy to do, or is it something you want to talk over with staff? Mr. Bjork.
Madam Chair, I believe what Mr. Carlson is trying to do is leave the program duration as it exists in current law, correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Was there a reason that Ms. Vanek wanted to change the duration?
Madam Chair, I'll let Ms. Vanek answer, but as she indicated, the utilization has generally not been beyond the three-year period that's envisioned by this bill. But again, you know, we're facing particular challenges due to the maturation of the baby boom.
Members,
Mr. Bjork,
I believe that what Mr. Carlson is trying to do could be done by striking Section 3 on deleting Section 3 on page 4, and on page 4, line 16, deleting 2022 and inserting 2024.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Carlson.
One more addition. It would also be deleting Section 2. That would, if you pass it, restrict us to only allowing this for former employees who subsequently elect to work for the same employer. We could not, in effect, allow this for somebody who comes from another government employer and works for the current employer.
Ms. Vanek?
Madam Chair, we don't have significant issues with the changes. Because the phased retirement program was designed to allow an employer to use the knowledge of somebody who wants to retire and to transition that knowledge to somebody hired to replace them, we didn't understand the significance of being able to go to a different employer because they're not then transferring their knowledge to the same employing entity. So the different employer didn't make sense to us. It was used once.
How do you define a governmental subdivision?
Madam Chair, governmental subdivision is defined in our statutes as city, county, school district for non-teaching.
Okay, so it's not just a different department within a governmental unit. It's a totally different government.
Yes,
Madam Chair.
And Mr. Carlson, why is this? It was used once. Why do you want to keep it?
Madam Chair, members, again, again, as we go further and further into the maturation of the baby boom, we're going to be facing substantial challenges in replacing that portion of our workplace. We need any flexibility that we can to replace them. And I agree with Ms. Vanek. Well, one of the reasons that was advanced when this originally was passed to allow a period of time for the retiring employee to transfer his or her knowledge to his or her replacement, from a broader perspective, we just need bodies any way we can get them. And so if another city's former employee can perform that function because of his or her experience, we'd be happy to take them.
Okay. Someone want to move to delete Section 2? Senator Goodwin moves to delete Section 2. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. And then extending the date on 4/16/2022 to 2024. Anybody have any issues with that?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. Someone want to move that? Representative Kahn moves on page 416 to delete the final two and insert a four.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Burek. Mr. Burek.
I didn't know I was elected.
I don't know if you were promoted or demoted with that.
I believe you'd also want to delete Section 3.
You have to delete Section 3.
Is that true, Ms. Vanek?
Yes. Madam Chair, yes.
Okay, then Representative Kahn moves to delete Section 3 and on 4.16 to change 2022 to 2024. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay, thank you. Mr. Rice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to direct my comments to Section 1 of the bill. This is on the issue of the para tracking overtime, and I'm Brian Rice. I'm appearing on behalf of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters and the Police Officers Federation of Minneapolis. Ms. Vanek said that the para was asked to assess the issue of whether there had been padding of pensions in the last 5 years to retirement based on the use of overtime. I believe that request either came from the news media or Ms. Crockett. So the commission knows, overtime is not an unusual aspect of compensation for police officers and some firefighters. But what the committee should know is that that work is done at the behest of the employer. It's not a matter that the employee just can go out and do that. If an employee works overtime, it's because the employer wants them to do it. And presumably, if the employer is asking them to do it, there's either a need for them to do it or the employer is using it to best run its business operations and maximize the employee's value. For example, in Minneapolis now, the Minneapolis Police Department is down 40 police officers from the budgeted number of police officers. And what the police department in Minneapolis is doing is working its employees overtime. They're saving a lot of money. Number one, they're saving $15,000 a year in health insurance costs. If they go out and hire a new employee, they're going to have to pay that much just to cover their employment. So that's $750 an hour before you start working at all. So I think this attempt is really the police officers that I represent take it as a slur on them that this is like an I gotcha or that this padding of pensions happens by them, and they really resent it, quite frankly. You just passed a provision that's largely going to benefit the management of these public employers. The 430 people that do this return to work stuff are not the police officer or the teachers or the street workers. They're the finance officers or the tech people or city manager types and things like that. And those 430 people aren't putting a dime into the pension system of Minnesota. They withdraw, they get compensation, they're no longer covered by a pension system. And it doesn't do anything to help the pension system. It's great for the public employers to help manage their operations, but it doesn't do anything to buck up the pension system or keep contributions coming in and stop the flow of benefits out of it. And so I guess we'd love you to take this out, but we also understand there's been a need by PARA to look at this information. I just want to go on record as if you're really going to – Minnesota has a high-five pension system. which means that if you're going to spike your pension, you're going to have to start like 5 years before you retire and build up these hours. And usually when you're within 5 years of retirement, your energy level and other things might not be as robust as you might be doing it when you were in your 20s. So if PARA is really going to study this longitudinally and look at when do employees build up over time and when do they not build it up, it's going to take quite a long time to have a valid study to say that you worked harder earlier in your career as opposed to later. And I think the supposition of this is there has been some cases around the country where this has happened, but those have been in states where they've had a high 1 year salary or even a high final month salary. In Minnesota, with a high five salary, is the longest period of time you need to build up your pension amount. So even the supposition that either the newspaper or Mrs. Crockett made about this, I think, is just false. I think you'd have to weigh that against the cost. I'm not here to speak for any employers, but my guess is that all 700-plus employing units in that work with PARA are going to have to tailor their payroll systems to get you this information to see really does it really benefit anyone and what's the cost. So it's certainly something PARA can ask for, but I did want to go on record on behalf of my clients to say this is a study that I would predict is going to lead nowhere, or maybe it's the study to nowhere on the topic. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Rice. Any other? We do have another issue. I'm sorry, Senator Rosen. We have one more issue. Mr. Martin.
Well, Mr. Burek it has an amendment that we've been requested to present.
Okay.
Members, it's my understanding that this is a...
Have copies been passed out?
Yeah. Section 7 of the bill deals with the early retirement reduction for county sheriffs, and it would seem logical, given that these individuals are retiring, that for purposes of the post-retirement adjustments, that they would also be accorded the same treatment. Basically, the treatment under Section 7 is we'll treat them as though... they had retired a bit earlier and completely avoided the phase-in of somewhat less generous early retirement adjustments. And I would assume that if the commission were to do that, that it would also want to take the same approach with the post-retirement adjustments that these individuals would be receiving. Because in PARA Police and Fire's post-retirement adjustment provision, the treatment is, in current law, a little different if you retire on or before June 1, 2014, rather than later. So what the amendment that has just been passed out does, and that is the -01A amendment, is it attempts to make the PARA post-retirement adjustment provision parallel the new Section 7.
Mr. Franklin with the county sheriffs, if you want to go forward. Ms. Vanek, are you familiar with this issue?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Mr. Franklin.
Madam Chair, Jim Franklin, Executive Director for the Sheriff's Association. When this PARA changes came forward last year, we had made a request to simply allow the sheriffs to complete their term, which would take them to the end of 2014. We agree with all of the changes. We're not asking for any special consideration, not asking for any rate adjustments or anything. We just wanted to allow them to finish their term so we didn't have somewhere between approximately 28 or 29 sheriffs that would have to make a decision to retire in midterm in June of 14. So we just simply wanted them to finish their term. We're not very good at this. We're good at cop work, but we're not good at this legislation. We thought we had it fixed, and we were advised that this particular portion had been missed in an oversight. And so we're just asking that this be corrected so that they can retire at the end of their term, which is usually the first week in January.
Ms. Fanick, any comments?
Madam Chair, it's just another special carve-out whenever you have these. There's that much more risk at having errors occur because they don't fit into the automated system. You made an exception for them last year where we don't have a official position on it.
It somehow it didn't take, though, the exception we made last year.
Well, Madam Chair, this particular piece of it was never raised last year, not with us. I understand from Mr. Franklin it was raised in conversations with legislators and LCPR staff, but we were not aware that this was something they wanted. Again, I'm not particularly happy about it, but it's not a decision for me to make. I would ask, however, that the date be changed on 3.4 to make the similar change that we made in our on the section of the law that we discussed.
Members, that would be on page 3, line 4, delete before February 1st, 2015, and insert by the final day in office in January 2014, comma, as reported by the county.
Madam Chair, 2015.
Someone want to move that amendment?
So moved.
Senator Hayden moves the for amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. All right. On the 1A amendment, Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, I'm sorry. Madam Chair, Mr. Franklin, then you are the source of this amendment?
Madam Chair, yes, we had requested, we brought this to the attention of the Chair and to the committee and requested this.
Does anyone want to move the 1A amendment?
Ms. Beerick? If I may raise a question, my understanding of Section 7 of the bill and this amendment is that this is to assist elected county sheriffs. Right now, the language of both Section 7 and this amendment just refers to county sheriffs. Is there a need to
clarify
limit
that?
To clarify that we are referring just to
are there any
sheriffs?
Appointed sheriffs, though, in the state? I don't think there are. I think they're all elected. Mr. Franklin.
Madam Chair, all sheriffs are elected. If they are replaced midterm, then they would be appointed by the county board. In this particular case, we do not have any sheriffs retiring in this category group that have been appointed. They have all been elected. So as to the technicality of the use of the word elected, there is only one sheriff. All other employees of the sheriff are deputy sheriffs, but there is only one county sheriff.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to get this straight in my head. Ms. Vanick mentioned, and maybe this question is for Ms. Vanick, is if we put this on, you're going to have to set up a separate system from what you do for your other para employees with the post-retirement adjustment. Is that what I heard?
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, our systems are programmed to identify by date of retirement the eligibility for the first post-retirement adjustment. So when you have a carve-out for however many people this may involve, whether or not the system can do that, I don't know that we can program for that, so we're going to have to do those manually. And that my concern is when you have 94,000 benefit recipients, there's always a chance that you're going to miss these special provisions. That it's more administrative concern.
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Mr. Franklin, will you remind me again who you represent?
The Director of the County Sheriff's. Mr. Sure. Franklin, just state your title.
Madam Chair, I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Sheriff's Association.
Okay. Madam Chair, Mr. Franklin, did I hear that with the amendment that was put on that this will only cover one person?
Madam Chair.
The proposed amendment, you mean, Representative Murphy?
Yeah.
The 1A?
1A, as it's been amended, yes.
It's proposed, yeah.
Yes.
Mr. Franklin.
Madam Chair, it would apply to only the 28 or 20, somewhere between 25 and 30. We do not know the exact number of who is going to retire, but the projected number currently that is within that, shall I say, bubble eligibility range would be 28, I believe, employees or sheriffs that would be eligible. Last year when I spoke to this group, we had intended and thought all of this was arranged in this package, not knowing the proper terms to use. We missed this particular portion, and when the bill was drafted, this particular piece was missed.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Franklin, and so this particular piece, there are 25 or 30 people that are eligible to go in on this.
Madam Chair, yes.
Mr. Franklin.
Is that you?
And Mr. Franklin, Madam Chair, what was that part about then, the appointed person?
We just had a discussion about whether sheriffs were elected or appointed. And Mr. Franklin said they're all elected unless somebody retires, somebody dies in office, and then the county board might appoint someone to replace him. But there's no one like that right now in the state.
Okay. And Madam Chair, Mr. Franklin, then will this just cover these 25 to 30 people one time or ongoing? Will
Mr.
that
Franklin.
Number 25 to 30 change?
Madam Chair, Representative, this is a one-time only for these 25 to 30 people that would be retiring all by January of 2015 deadline.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Fanick.
I just want to point out that I don't want whoever's going to be here next year representing Perry to have to deal with this again. This line 3.5, better put my glasses on, I think needs to be amended to meet Mr. Franklin's intent, because there are going to be sheriffs who are over the age of 55 who are in this group. And so if they're going to be retiring, the way I read this, they have to be between 50 and 55 to have to avoid the longer wait for their post-retirement adjustment. If they're over 55, the way I read this would mean they'd still have to wait the longer period for their post-retirement adjustment. And I don't think that's what he wants. I think he wants any of these sheriffs who are not going to run for re-election or who don't win re-election to not have to wait the longer period we imposed last year for the first post-retirement adjustment. So I would say that in line 3.5, you'd strike but less than age 55. Mr. Barrick, does that make sense to you?
Madam Chair, members, I guess it depends on what you're trying to accomplish.
Well,
I mean, if the purpose of this provision is to cover solely the individuals covered in Section 7 of the bill, which deals only with early retirement.
Just a minute, members. Senator Rosen really needs to leave, so we're going to set this amendment aside for further discussion, and we're just going to take up the base bill. So Representative Murphy moves that Senate File 2015, House File 2524, be recommended to be incorporated into the omnibus bill. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Okay, so to be discussed, we'll be sure that we will complete our discussion on this. Representative Nelson.
And Madam Chair, maybe I'm just reading something wrong, but between the amendment on 3.17 and on 6.28, there's two different expiration dates. Are they dealing with the same thing, or are they two different dates? One's 2015, one's 2016. Well, I guess no, one's January. That's right. Okay, I see. Yeah. One's February, one's January. Never mind.
All right. And I think maybe the sheriffs need to have some further discussions with members so they understand this issue. Okay. Meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.
Make it to my dinner.
I'm missing one, too.
Yeah. I didn't make it to Rochester.
Rochester, where the pork producers had their thing.